Welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today our special guest is John Ritchie. John, welcome to the show.
Pleased to be on the show.
John, just to give us a quick introduction to the people who haven't heard of you, you are a native of Roslyn Chapel. Roslyn Chapel, which features in The Da Vinci Code as the finale. You have seen the phenomenon happening. You are still very much at the heart of the phenomenon. And we have known each other for several years. In fact, I think we know each other since somewhere in 1997. When we ended up talking until about 4 o'clock in the morning at the time of our first meeting. And what I find interesting and what I think, when I think of Roslyn, I identify Roslyn with you because you're one of those people who literally safeguards the place. And Kathleen, you have a very funny incident which kind of like brought that home to you when we were in Roslyn a few weeks ago.
Wait, I'm not sure which incident you're talking about.
Oh, when you saw John just making sure that he was taking care of the interior of the carvings all by himself.
Watching John and Roslyn is pure joy. It's wonderful to see somebody who knows a place so well and who is such a part of that place. I have been investigating Roslyn for many, many years. I've been reading about it since the 90s, but this was my first trip there. It's been one of those things where since 1995, I've been trying to get there, and every time I'm in Scotland, something happens. So I am coming back from Scotland, just home for a few days, really fresh and excited to talk about this because as much as I knew I would love it, as fascinating as I knew the place was, I think I was completely unprepared for the emotional reaction that this extraordinary legacy had upon me. It's an incredible place, and to be able to see it with John's assistance was really an extraordinary experience. So I'm excited to talk about it today and share that with our listeners.
So John, as they say, over to you. Kind of, you grew up with Roslyn Chapel and Roslyn Castle, literally, a few hundred yards away from where you live. How was it in the days of you growing up there and having this extraordinary chapel, which hardly anybody at the time knew about?
Well, the thing was that we just saw it as our backyard, almost, if you like. But the thing with Roslyn was I've kind of grown up with both the castle and the chapel, and I have no fear. I mean, I meet people all the time who either love the chapel or are actually intimidated by the chapel, and believe it or not, some of the Earls of Roslyn have been like that in the past as well, that they have felt intimidated by the chapel. It's very interesting that the chapel has this effect on people. It has a very different effect on quite a lot of people. I kind of mourn the quietness of the place. I mean, 15, 20 years ago, more than that probably now, it was a lovely, quiet place to be. And you could hear yourself think. Nowadays, it's a constant flow of people coming through. I don't mind that because I think it's good that people actually see something that is so special. I have in the past been looking at something with either my camera or a pair of binoculars, and I remember one incident where a small Spanish lady dug me in the ribs with her elbows just to push me out of the way to see what I was looking at. And when I said, "Oh, this is a bit unusual," she sort of looked at me in a very quizzical way, saying, "Well, you were standing too long," or something like that. Yeah. But I used to play in the castle when I was a boy. My friend was a chap called Neil Leach. We were school friends, and his aunt actually looked after the castle. She was a the caretaker, principally. And she lived in this huge castle on her own with a couple of dogs and a couple of cats. And that was it. She was a pretty remarkable person. I always remember we had quite a lot of experiences down there. All kinds of things that we came across, and a couple of times quite strange phenomena happened. I suppose as children you are much more sympathetic, but we were more concerned with in the season of collecting jackdaw's eggs, because there were hundreds of jackdaws that nested in the castle, and jackdaw's eggs were like gold. You could trade them for anything at school, because at that time you had, people collected birds' eggs. They don't now, thank goodness, but they did at that time. So what we had was a constant revenue from jackdaw's eggs that we collected at the castle. And we used these at school as a form of currency, which was very good, you know.
So basically you're saying there is a treasure of Roslyn.
Yeah, well, jackdaw's eggs could be a treasure of Roslyn. What was very strange was there was quite a few jackdaws in and around Roslyn that actually spoke. And, they were like the minor birds. They spoke like a minor bird. And this was very, very strange, because I had an uncle who used to keep birds, and he said that often what happened was if the jackdaw's tongues were slightly cut underneath, then they could actually speak. And what we think is that there was a strain of jackdaws there that literally were used to guard the castle. Because if there was a noise, the whole flock of jackdaws would rise up. And some of them were quite verbal. And this was very much the case for hundreds of years, I think. But the castle itself is pretty remarkable. It was built after 1303. And it was actually built in a French style, although it was designed by a soldier who was captured at the Battle of Roslyn. And it had a couple of towers. One of them was called Little John, and the other one was called Robin Hood. And this tied into what were called the morality plays that were performed at Roslyn and at the castle. There was a flat area just below the castle where it was like a village green, if you like, at one time, and this was where the gypsies stayed. They were given sanctuary by the earls, the Sinclairs, who were the earls of Caithness, and they were protected by the Sinclair, even though the king had kicked off a pogrom against them. So it's always had a very special sense, both the castle and the chapel. The chapel, of course, is, I mean, it's a very magic place. It's a library in stone, and we've not even touched the edges really of understanding what it is completely about yet. I love, there's always a lovely sort of thing. You get authors coming there all the time, and they'll look on the wall and they'll find a carving that backs the theory, and you can see them saying, "Well, this carving backs my theory." But in actual fact, the place is so full of carvings that it's like a lexicon anyway. And I always think when they're going away, as they turn their back, the chapel is laughing its head off, you know.
Well, I'm certainly one of those authors that was walking through going, I'm going to find, you know, backup for my theory. And I did. Of course I did, because like you said, there's so much there. The gypsy connection to me that you were just discussing was fascinating. I know that I was, and I've studied the gypsies a lot, particularly the gypsies in France and the connection of Sainte-Marie de la Mer. But I was really surprised to hear that there was such a powerful gypsy connection in Rosslyn. And you actually believe that gypsies were responsible for some of the carvings. Is that correct?
I believe that some of the carvings were done by gypsies. I think possibly the Green Men. And that the whole influence of the Green Man in Rosslyn, the animistic side of religion, I think, is probably down to the gypsies, because it is, they are aware of the seasons much more than anybody else was. And certainly the spirit of the woods, or the spirit of spring, which is the Green Man, of course. It's Chernobus, I think it's called in Celtic. And it's often referred in medieval period as Herne the Hunter, which is the stag, the man with the stag's head. But this, the morality plays were very interesting. The gypsies came to Rosslyn to perform these morality plays. Now, I think we're often confusing the word gypsy with the word troubadour. And I think some of these people that came to Rosslyn, you know, they weren't gypsies as we probably, you know, it's a very misused word, the word gypsy. But I believe that troubadours, who were the local newscasters, if you like, and carried the news everywhere, I believe that they were part of what was happening at Rosslyn. I think we had court at Rosslyn, certainly in 1456 to about 1470, that was second to none in the UK. I think it was even greater than the King's Court in London, simply because all these amazing artisans and people were there. We know that, for example, there were bookbinders. We know, for example, that there was gold and silver artists. We know that there was wood carvers, and we know there were stone carvers. So we have right through, I think we thought we had all the trades there, and it was a court of learning. And this, of course, it comes back to what we were talking about with libraries, that wherever you got a library, it was a humanitarian thing to put a library together, because that way, by doing that, you were then educating the people who had access to that library.
Absolutely. I mean, just to kind of like put it into perspective and kind of like backtrack into something which you said a bit earlier, you saw all of these people come there with their theories. We've had theories from the head of Christ is buried there, some secret scrolls belonging to the Essenes were taken by the Templars and were buried there, somehow the missing link between Templars and Freemasons are there. There's like, you know, like there's like almost thousands of treasures which are supposed to be in Rosslyn. You kept away from that until really the Da Vinci Code kind of like effect had passed, and then you began to divulge some of your own stuff, which you had compiled over years and years of research, and that's beginning to paint a very different picture of Rosslyn, and specifically, you're beginning to zoom in onto who really began to build Rosslyn, who, as it just happens, is a very interesting guy with a gigantic library and interest in books.
I think that what we have at Rosslyn is a depository of knowledge. I think that they were panicking a bit about the burning of books by Savonarola and the destruction of books on the continent. And I think that is part of Rosslyn's task, was that parts of books were actually carved into the stonework. So what I know that we've identified about six different books, one of them being the Order of Chivalry, one of the others being Bonnet's Honour in the fact that the Dance of Death comes out of Bonnet's Honor Bonnet's book. A lot of very early important books, extracts were taken from that and carved into the stone. And I believe that actually happened for two reasons. We had a lot of people that couldn't read, but because they're cartoon carvings, you didn't need to be able to read to understand the actual carvings. You could look at it, and the visual representation, like a cartoon, was self-explanatory. And I think that was a great part of Roslin, was the fact that he didn't need to be able to read to understand what this building was saying to you. And that doesn't happen in many places. It happens in Roslin. It may happen in parts of Chart and very special places like that. But as far as that's concerned, you know, it is very, very unique on that basis. I suppose I'm very lucky that I have lived with it most of my life and I'm able to see past the actual initial impact. I'm always interested in the first time people visit the chapel because of the actual impact it has on them when they look at this thing and they think, my God, you know, I've been going into the chapel for 60 years and I'm still seeing things that I never noticed before. And I say noticed, I've probably seen them before, but I hadn't taken note of them. And every time I'm in the chapel, I see something that I haven't really noticed before. And I think that's a fantastic thing about the chapel. It's just, if I've been doing that for the length of time I have, you know, it's the thought of the amount of carvers necessary to do the work that was actually done in Roslin. And that's it. I remember in the beginning, before, there were several people kind of accused me of jumping on the bandwagon, and I had to sort of give them my Son of the Soil accreditation. And one of the things I did was I said, well, my family have always supported Roslin Chapel and will continue to do so, because there's about 10 of them buried on the hill that the chapel is built on, so they are actually supporting the chapel. But this actually happens. This happens a lot. We got a lot of different theories of treasure. It's interesting that when documentary programs, particularly National Geographic or History Channel, when they're on a search or a quest for something and they can't find it, they always turn around and say, ah, but we know where it is. It's in the vault at Roslin, which is a very easy out. But the actual, you know, this has happened countless times. It happened with a chap who was searching for the Ark of the Covenant. Suddenly the Ark of the Covenant is in Roslin. I mean, if all that is to be believed, I mean, this is probably where the ideas of the film National Treasure came from. You know, where you have got all these, we've got these wonderful treasures. But it is very much a case of it is used quite a lot when people cannot find what they're looking for. Oh, it's suddenly in Roslin. And who knows, maybe it is.
Well, I think you are actually saying that the secret of Roslin is for there and everybody to see. It's in the carvings. You just need to be able to understand them. And the man responsible for that is the guy. Everybody, or most people before you, were always focusing on Sir William Sinclair himself, the man who allegedly did it all by himself, but you really added a completely new dimension to that. And actually, you identified Sir Gilbert Hay as a man who is equally, if not more important than Sir William Sinclair. So can you tell us a bit more about him and kind of how his contribution to the chapel works?
Well, one of the things that interested me right from the start was that I looked at William. And William was a very busy man. He was the Chancellor of Scotland. He was almost the regent of Scotland for James, the King James at that time, which was James II, and he was a very, very busy, and he had lands both in Orkney, in Caithness, in down in the borders, and he was called upon to do many other duties. Now, he was a very rich individual, and he became even more rich when the king bought Orkney from him, and he was given a large amount of money, but he was also given the lands of Caithness as part of the deal. And this was where most of the money for building Roslyn came from. But of course, if you are a really busy person like that, you know, you would not have had the time to develop Roslyn as it was developed. And you also had to be incredibly knowledgeable to know all these things, to be able to instruct carvers to actually carve them into the stone. And William Sinclair met this man, Sir Gilbert Hay. Sir Gilbert Hay, actually, we believe, is one of the Hays of Errol, which is up in Aberdeenshire. And he went to St. Andrews, or a record of him being at St. Andrews University at the same time as Walter Byrne. And Walter Byrne wrote this Scoticonicon, which is one of the most important history books in Scotland. And Gilbert Hay actually later edited that after Walter Byrne's death. But prior to that, he qualified in 1419. It would appear that he was about the same age as William Sinclair. He went off to France to do a doctorate in Paris and finished up as the Chancellor and Librarian to the French King. Now, whether that came about through the Sinclair, which I find quite interesting, because certainly William Sinclair took one of the king's sisters to Paris to actually marry a French prince. And there's a record of this, and the fact that when he went to Paris, he took 100 retainers with him, all dressed in velvet with gold chains, and there's quite a good description of what actually happened. Now, whether William Sinclair met Gilbert Hay then or not, it's hard to say. But there's quite a lot of references to Gilbert Hay having connections to the Anjou family, which of course was the most important French family at that time in France. And particularly René d'Anjou was the head of the family and was also the titular head of the King's Jerusalem, which still existed at that time. He was also said to be the King of Naples, and as well as having this incredible French connection by being brought up with Charles VII, the French king. And also the person that ties in at this time, who was discovered by Isabella, was, of course, Joan of Arc. And this ties into this. And there's a reference, whether it is correct or not, there's a reference that Sir Gilbert Hay was knighted by the French king after his coronation. And this was the point where he obviously connected with the French king, and for something like 20 years was his chamberlain and his librarian. So Gilbert could wander about. We know that he was a very good scholar, because it said that he could speak and translate something like 16 languages, which was remarkable at that time. But he certainly he certainly was an avid book collector and traveled about Europe, and possibly we know that he went into Morocco, because on Walter Bowman's reference to Gilbert Hay, there is several hundred notes from Gilbert Hay talking about Cathay, talking about Morocco, talking about different parts of Europe where he visited and collected bits and pieces from. And this is, when he comes back to Scotland, he's regarded as being, he says he comes back to educate the children of William St. Clair, which, of course, he duly does, but I think there was much more of a purpose to what he was doing. And I think that purpose really was built around a religious philosophy. And certainly, the chapel itself reflects probably more to do with John the Baptist than it does to do with Christ. Although it doesn't deny Christ in any way at all, but it features more of what happened to John the Baptist than it does to Christ.
I mean, one of the things, John, you also found during your research is actually some new features. I mean, the chapel is dedicated to St. Matthew. His feast day is the fall equinox. And you found features in the chapel itself which contribute to that understanding, and also to something known as the Shekinah.
Yeah. Well, I think that what is very interesting about Roslyn is that as you move through parts of Roslyn, you're moving through sort of biblical history. And certainly, when you get to the Rector Choir, you're in the area of Judeo-Christian philosophy. The inner rectangle, if you like, is New Testament. The outer parts are Old Testament, and as I say, as you gravitate towards the altar, the East End, then in the Rector Choir, you find all these biblical references, particularly from the Talmud and from the early Christian references. For example, There is a reference to the Darius, the king of Persia. There's also a reference to Alexander the Great. So this is all built into the chapel as part of the sort of historical cycle of the chapel. This is just another one of the cogs in the wheels that actually make up Roslyn, because on top of that we have the astrological side of Roslyn, which without a doubt is linked into the stars and is really about knowing when to plant the crops or when to harvest. But principally, I suppose the thing that we really identified was the fact that why was this place dedicated to Matthew? Because Matthew is not somebody that a lot of buildings are actually dedicated to. You don't find a lot of places dedicated to Matthew. And yet Matthew was probably the best educated disciple of all. He was certainly the recorder of a lot of things. He records really from the point of the baptism of Christ. He records that whole period quite accurately. And this is where I think that the streams of religious philosophy split up, and particularly the Johannite and the Christian is the fact that Paul was said to translate all the Gospels, but of course Paul was the one editor in all of this, and they were further changed, of course, at the Council of Nicaea to make them acceptable. But they never actually translated the original Gospel of Matthew, which was in Aramaic. And there is an American scientist, an American intellectual, who spent something like 40 years of his life chasing down the history of Matthew in Matthew's Gospel. And he's come to the same conclusion that the Gospel that was translated by Paul was translated from the Greek, and it was never taken directly from the Aramaic, which, of course, was what Matthew was writing in. So it was looking at this connection and why Matthew that actually brought us to the Gospel of Myrna that is recorded from Matthew, which talks about the tree of life or the staff of life. And I got a little bit fed up with the whole Masonic overtones of the apprentice pillar. I mean, we had this, we even wore it on our blazers when we were at school, which was the apprentice pillar on a pocket of our blazers. And so it was an image that was kind of burnt into my memory. But the interesting thing to me is that this story did not come about until about 1780. And who was visiting Roslyn Chapel in about 1780? None other than the great Scottish bard himself, Robert Burns. And that is where the whole story of the apprentice pillar comes from, that period. Meg Wilson, who Burns even wrote a poem about, she told him about the chapel, and she was looking for more visitors to the chapel. And so Burns came up with this Masonic story, which, although, you know, I mean, the chapel itself is certainly built to Masonic, particularly the actual practical side of stonemasonry. And by being built to that, it contains a lot of Masonic symbolism, as it would do. Although the overlay of the speculative Masonic side has actually probably got more confused as time has gone on, you know?
Absolutely. So you identified the fact that the apprentice pillar is not so much an apprentice pillar, but a St. Matthew's staff. Where does that leave Roslyn Chapel as a whole? Kind of like, how are we supposed to be reading Roslyn Chapel for real?
Well, I think the way to read Roslyn is, if you're interested in early astronomy, there's something there for you. If you're interested in animism, early animism, then there's another level for you to study. If you're interested in the early biblical side, there's another level. It's rather like an onion, and that at certain points they all link up. I think it's still very much an enigma to us, and will continue to be so, because I think it was built at a time when really, if it had been consecrated, it would have had to been consecrated by a cardinal. And if he had seen what had actually gone on at Roslyn, I think he would have been calling for firewood and oil to burn everybody involved, because it was a very different time. So it was never really properly consecrated as a chapel at that time. And that's what interests me, is that here we have this incredible building full of these incredible carvings, but there is only one true altar on it, and that's the Lady Altar, which is totally offset. It's actually at the right-hand side of the chapel, which is above the staircase that goes down into the vault. So it has all these different levels, and And so it has all these different levels of interest to the different people that are interested in these subjects. I mean, there was a person recently came up with the story about the cubes being music. And I have to say that I had my suspicions about that, because he suddenly discovered this when Tom Hanks was here filming The Da Vinci Code, the very week that he was here, which I thought was a bit suspicious. But it was finally topped off by an old man who used to repair the chapel, Joe. And old Joe said, "Well, I think that man's a very clever man, you know. A very clever man, that chap has discovered that music." He said, "Because I must have repaired at least 20 of these cubes and put them up again, you know." And this was old Joe. He had been the sort of handyman about the place for about 40 years. And with a result, he had actually put some of the cubes back up there that had fallen down. Yeah. So he said, "It's very, very clever, that man. He managed to write a piece of music on it." You know?
So, well, I was really struck by the Matthew connection. And one of the things that I wanted to point out that we talked about, but we haven't talked about today, is that also Matthew is the patron saint of librarians.
That's right.
And I think that leads us, you know, further into your theory that this is a library in stone, and that would make so much more sense to have Matthew's connection. Now, I wanted to ask you something. I got into a bit of a row online with someone this week, as I am wont to do, about Rosslyn, because I was rhapsodizing about how wonderful it was, and he came on and he was, you know, determined to burst my bubble and tell me that it was strictly the private chapel of the Sinclairs. They were Catholics. They held masses there. They never meant for it to endure. They never meant it to teach anyone. It was strictly a private family chapel, and we're all making, you know, a very big deal about something, and that, you know, we're just all reading something into it that isn't really there. How do you respond to people like that, and people who say the Sinclairs were Catholics, there were masses here, that's what this is about?
Very simply, there are no records of masses as such. There were prebenders that were employed in Singing Boys later. But as far as that's concerned, you know, I would say the thing that refutes all of what he's just said is, you tell me another chapel that is so well carved. You show me another chapel that has stories carved into the stonework. So as far as that's concerned, he's totally off the wall, because the rocks remain, as they say, and the truth is actually carved in stone.
And how would you, what is your interpretation of the famous inscription? There is only one inscription in the entire chapel. It's very, very interesting. It's in Latin. It is a reference to King Darius, as you said, but it's very interesting, right? Wine is strong. The king is stronger. Women are stronger still, but truth conquers all. For you, what does that mean?
Well, I think to me, it basically lays out the formula. The king, but the women are placed higher than the king, which I think is very, very interesting. But also, the truth is much more important. I think that it comes, if you examine the background of where it comes from this competition between these architects to build a temple. And I think that it's probably one of the earliest statements about building a temple. With a result, what you actually have is probably one of the earliest references. It's the same as, I took Dr. Robert Feather with me to the chapel. He'd never been to the chapel before. And Robert Feather, as we know, is a world-renowned historical metallurgist. And he's also somewhat of an expert in Egyptian and Byzantine and Abyssinian architecture. So I asked him if he would point out things that were particularly interesting to him from an Egyptian point of view and from a Babylonian point of view. And one of the first things he pointed out to me was this reference to Darius. And he said, well, that's very important because it actually symbols, it talks about the first temple. Now, if we were talking in animistic terms, as far as Roslyn is concerned, and we were talking from a druidic point of view, the first temple to the druids was a tree in the forest. And you could also look at Matthew's staff or the tree of life as being that very tree in the forest. And that it, in a way, was the first temple as well, the first praises to whatever god they were actually praising. But that pillar, if it becomes a tree, becomes the druidic temple. And I find that quite fascinating, that there's this duality of the carvings. And this is something, though, people take the whole thing literally, that there are some fantastic comic drawings and some fantastic comic carvings. And people, you know, you've got to see it through the eyes of the masons. You've got to try and see it through the eyes of the contemporary people. We can't really judge. We can only look and we can only work on it. And for somebody to come out with hard facts like this, I mean, I've heard this before loads of times from different people. It's an intellectual, it's a so-called intellectual approach. Oh, it was only a family chapel. Well, I'm sorry, but it wasn't only a family chapel. If it was a family chapel, it would be a very simple chapel like Seton or some of the other collegiate chapels in Scotland. They bear no resemblance to Roslyn. And as far as that's concerned, you know, anybody that says that has really not done any work on Roslyn, because it's only by being there and actually doing some work on the carvings that you start realizing what an amazing amount of knowledge is actually carved into the walls.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I have never seen anything that comes close to me, comes close to Chartres Cathedral, but Roslyn does. And I think that those two structures are sister structures of a kind, in that they are both definitely books in stone. And for me, when I look at Roslyn, it is impossible to think that this building was not made with intention in every single inch. There is not a square foot of that chapel that someone did not very, very carefully consider. There's nothing random there. It's an extraordinary piece of art and architecture. I mean, it's truly phenomenal. And there is no way that someone did this as a folly or as an accident or as something that was not 1,000% considered. It was a considered structure. And I think that, you know, the person I had this argument with, as an example, had never been to Roslyn, which I, you know, was apparent in the first sentence of his argument, because you cannot be there, as you say, and see this and experience it without realizing that there is something going on here that is so much bigger, that is such a celebration of wisdom and knowledge and truth and the human spirit. It's an extraordinary place.
Absolutely. I mean, I totally agree with you. It has to be experienced. It's all very well to come up with glib explanations like that, but really, when it comes down to it, if he had spent any time in Roslyn, he'd have changed his mind about that. The interesting thing is, if he really wants to know about the family chapel was in the castle, and that kind of puts a tin hat on it as far as his theories are concerned, because there was a small chapel in the castle, and there's even an early piscina there, which was part of the devotions, if you like, of the people in the actual castle, rather than walking all the way up to the chapel, which they probably did on a Sunday. We know, for example, that the actual family chapel was the crypt down below, and that most of the actual altars that we see there now were actually put in 1862. And so, you know, you cannot make sweeping statements like that without seeing the place, you know. That nullifies his comments right away, really.
And yeah. I mean, as you say, everybody who kind of like goes through the chapel falls in love with it, and you're kind of like identifying the 1860s. And at that moment in time, the chapel was really in a bad shape. And I believe I'm correct in saying that Queen Victoria comes there, and she's very much familiar with the then Sinclair master in command, so to speak, Francis. And Kathleen, you definitely fell in love with Francis Sinclair. Because you saw his contribution to the chapel in a completely new light.
I did, and I realized that there's not much attention paid to him because he is late to the party. His additions, in yes. fact, I know a lot of people aren't happy about his additions, but I did find some of the things he did were extremely beautiful and also very enigmatic. I mean, here's a man who adds some female sculptures to the exterior of the church, has his tomb, bears the inscription that love conquers death. So I was very fascinated by the fourth Earl Francis.
I think Francis was, I think Francis actually loved the chapel. It's very, very interesting how, you know, one generation doesn't always venerate what the previous generation does. But certainly, Francis's father really started off the restoration in 1862. And Francis picked up the baton in the 1870s. Late 1860s, when he changed the window. And the window was actually a commemoration to commemorate the death of his sister, who was the Countess of Munster. And it was finished in 1872. And in 1880, of course, he started on the baptistry, and he built the baptistry. But he was very sympathetic, or he believed he was very sympathetic towards the chapel, and at least by his work, the chapel was actually saved. It was very interesting. It was said to be William Wordsworth and his sister that influenced Victoria coming to the chapel. But of course, as soon as Victoria came to the chapel, there was a massive interest. She was the Elvis of her day, if you like. Wherever she went, you know, the hordes would follow. And that's exactly what happened with the chapel, and that allowed them to actually rebuild parts of the chapel that had badly fallen down. And it's like the present restoration. They've been very, very sympathetic towards what's going on, and I think they've done a fantastic job. It started off, I mean, I was part of the management committee of the Friends of Roslyn. And unfortunately, there were a lot of disagreements. But what we now see is that ever since Colin Glenn-Percy became the project director, he has made a huge difference to the whole restoration project. And they've just finished the roof. The roof has been redone, and very sympathetically. That will definitely last for another 200 years. So it's a job very well done. I mean, there may be a much bigger job to do in removing the lime wash, the cement wash, on the carvings. I think that's going to be a very difficult thing to do. I believe they're going to also relay the floor, clean the slabs and relay the floor. But we'll wait and see what happens. As I say, each phase is difficult because it's a very, you know, what you find is that the stone carvers and the masons are extremely sensitive towards the chapel and do the best work they possibly can. And I think that's a wonderful thing about Roslyn Chapel, is that not one carving is the same. The tracery around the chapel, the vines and things, are the same pattern, but for the most part, every carving is different. And I believe that that's tied up with the fact that what we actually have is a philosophy which believes that man, or man himself, is unique, as is woman for that matter, and because of that uniqueness, it gives them the perfect right to contact their God without having a priest or a minister or any form of church administration involved. That originality comes from the same source, is that the carvings are unique and the human is unique. So therefore, that gives them the right to contact their own God without intercession.
Absolutely, and I think that is also a message which, as you say, was extremely revolutionary in those days. Do you think that is something that Gilbert Hay developed on his own, or do you think he was part of a stream of people who really...
I think he was part of a stream of people. I think that he was certainly the depository of a lot of knowledge that came from, that surrounded this whole philosophy. But they certainly, from that point of view, he seemed to be part of a group. Whether it was a leftover from the time of the Crusades, or whether it was the court of the King of Jerusalem, I don't know. But I do know that there were quite a few people involved in this. And that certainly the Anjou family was at the centre of it, you know. And there is links even later between the Anjou family and the Sinclairs as well. So there is connections there all the way through.
So the Da Vinci Code, good for Rosslyn or bad for Rosslyn?
Well, I used to think it was bad for Rosslyn because of the amount of people that flowed through it, you know, because some Sundays you were getting 1,000 people going through the chapel. Now, you can't really see anything when there's 1,000 people sort of wandering through the chapel. But I think in the end, it allowed the prestige of the chapel to travel further, particularly into Europe, because a lot of the funding for the restoration of the chapel came from Europe. So in the end, I think it can be judged as being a good thing for Rosslyn. I think that it would have been very nice if Dan Brown had actually visited the chapel before he did write the book, instead of relying on his wife to do that part of the research, because it was his wife that visited Rosslyn. But he didn't actually visit Rosslyn until we were making the film here. And I'm sure if he had visited Rosslyn, there would have been probably quite a lot more about the chapel. So, yeah, I think in the end, I think Dan Brown was, you know, he was good for the chapel. I think the film has been good for the chapel as well. And Tom Hanks has been very generous towards the chapel as well. He has endowed it with certain funds as well. So I think in the end, if you had asked me when there was 1,000 people flowing through the chapel and you couldn't see anything but people, you know, it would have been a totally different answer you would have got from me. But certainly now, there's a kind of constant flow now, but it's not nearly as big. And it also employs a lot of people, and that's what's important. It employs a lot of local people, and that is a very, very important thing, because the people that it does employ love the chapel, and you can tell that from the enthusiasm of the guides. There are very few guides at Rosslyn that are not enthusiastic about the charge, you know.
Absolutely. And, John, we've come to the end of our show, but I think we have to reveal that you are the real treasurer of Rosslyn. have been so for more than 60 years, and hopefully will continue to do so for many more decades. Your book is called Rosslyn Revealed. We will put the link up on the website. It is written by John Ritchie and together with Alan Butler. We are The Spirit Revolution. You can visit us on www.thespiritrevolution.com. This show, as all our other shows, are archived on the BBS Archive. Most of our shows, almost a year of them now, are available on iTunes. We are indeed in our second year. The last five shows are also always available from thespiritrevolution.com. So, John, thank you for being our guest.
A pleasure.
Until the next time.
The truth against the world.